Hey there, how are you all doing? Welcome to the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. My name is Kevin Davani, the Total Connector. There's a brilliant author out there. His name is Gael Sanchez Smith, and he's an Austrian economist, Bitcoin economist. He's doing his master's in Austrian economics, and I really appreciate for taking his time. He wrote an article that's called "Once Inflation Starts, It Won't Be Contained." That's one of his latest articles. So he talks about inflation, the high levels of public and private debt, and that that the governments and the central banks are sort of trapped in this really bad cycle, and they can't get out of it because they would unleash a socioeconomic and political crisis. And they can't even, raise the interest rates because that would cause household and corporate defaults that would result in financial crisis and a depression that beyond our imagination. And the government would be then forced, as Gael says in his article, to balance the budget, imposing severe austerity that would lead to intergenerational social conflict. So bunch of topics, bunch of questions we're going to discuss. Bitcoin, inflation, deflation, the future of humanity, and if you have any questions afterwards or any input, let me know. I'm really looking forward. Without further ado, this is my talk with Gael Sanchez Smith. Hope you're gonna love it as much as I do, and talk to you soon. Thanks. Welcome to the show. My very special guest is Gael Sanchez Smith, and Gael, thank you so much for coming on my show. How are you doing?
Thank you, Kevin. Yeah, thanks a lot. It's a pleasure. Big fan of the show, so it's great to be here.
Yeah, I can always say the same. Listen, I read your article. I didn't read all your articles, but the last one or one of your last ones, it's called "Once Inflation Starts, It Won't Be Contained," and that's from June 12th. You already published maybe one or two other articles, I think, in September, right?
I wrote a couple of articles in Spanish before that, but that was my first article in English, and I really enjoyed writing it up. I'm actually finishing a master's in Austrian economics.
Oh, wow, congratulations. Yeah. Okay, finally someone in a master. I mean, because we've never been taught Austrian economics, and it's like so suppressed in universities, so.
Yeah, it's funny how you have to go to Spain to study Austrian economics. Apparently it's harder in Austria than in Spain. But we actually have two masters in Spain. One of them is online, and the other one is in person with Jesus Huerta del Soto.
I read his book. Isn't that money, credit, bank, something like cycles, something like that? It was like a huge, like a thick book.
Yeah. Well regarded, and he runs a master's in person in Madrid, and I did one online with Juan Ramon Rayo. He's another Spanish Austrian economist. He's actually a disciple of Jesus Huerta del Soto, but he took Austrian economics and merged it a bit with, he calls it liquidity theory. So the work of Antal Fekete, a Hungarian economist. So it's been good. It's been good. And the article is heavily influenced by what I've been taught during the master's.
Mm-hmm. I have the impression that somehow, I don't know, is it the Spanish scholars or economists? There are more, I don't know, they found out, into the rabbit hole of Austrian economics more than other scholars from other countries. Could that be? Because, the Soto,
It seems it's quite it's a good question. I wonder why, because I think it's probably Jesus who he's very well regarded. And I think he started this master's in Madrid, and a lot of people have gone through it, and then they've kind of given Austrian economics a bit more of a voice. But it's really big. Especially in the investment community in Spain, Austrian economics is well read. Probably more so than in other countries.
Yeah, great. So let's talk about your article. You know what I love about your article is that you tied in everything together with Jeff Booth, you know, his book. You've obviously read his book, you know, The Price of Tomorrow, Why Deflation is the Key to an Abundant Future. You quoted, you know, all our friends, you know, like Ben Kaufman and Stephanie von Jahn. I mean, they're all brilliant minds, you know, would it be like explaining the root causes, you know, would it be central banking system, the boom and bust cycles by Ben Kaufman. So, you know, I give you the stage, Gael. Why don't you just tell my listeners, like, what are the key points that you wanted to emphasize or bring through? You know, I know it's one issue that I love about what you talked about is like the breach of trust. You know, that's why I took that title for the for our episode. You know, like, it seems like, you know, governments and central banks don't want to learn out of history. I mean, it's more than conspicuous now, but. Is that a trust issue we have, like generally in society, as well as in the monetary, you know, field?
I mean, the article has been influenced by Ben and Stephanie, Emil also, who's been on your show, and I think the three of them are brilliant. And essentially, I think the main thesis of the article is that in the event of inflation, central banks are going to have a lot of trouble containing it, preserving the value of fiat currencies. So there is an element of trust because, in a sense, like the whole system is predicated upon people trusting it. I mean, the fiat currency system. I mean, the article doesn't propose that inflation is an imminent threat. It doesn't claim that we're going to get hyperinflation next month or even next year. But it does say that in the event of inflation, central banks are going to have a big trouble containing it and preserving the value of the currency. I go into the reasons why I believe that is the case. And I think trust is a big thing because in a way, fiat currencies, if like in a way, in a sense, the value of them are based on expectation. So if we expect that the currency is going to preserve its value, then we'll be happy keeping it in our cash balance or in our bank account or wherever. But if we're not sure about that, if we don't have the assurance that they're going to be able to preserve it, then we're in big trouble and the currency is in big trouble. So I think that's the main thesis of the article. And we can go into like the reasons why I believe so. I try to start out the article with a theory of the value of fiat currencies, which is a bit different maybe from the Austrian mainstream line. It's a bit different from Jesús Huerta de Soto and other Austrian thinkers in a sense. And it's also very different from the Keynesian and the Chartist point of view, obviously, because I think they both take a bit more of an objective theory of the value of fiat currency. So, for instance, if you ask an Austrian, they would say that any increase in the quantity of money is going to lead to inflation. Now, Austrians, not all Austrians, but many have tended to pose that that's the case, and a lot of them have been wrong, especially after 09. We got quantitative easing. A lot of economists, Austrians and otherwise, were kind of bracing for hyperinflation. They were warning everyone there's going to be big inflation, and it didn't really happen. It didn't occur, at least in the CPI. So, on the one hand, Austrians, I think they put a lot of emphasis on the quantity of money. They believe that if it increases, then we're going to get inflation. Whereas the Chartists believe that the state can decree the value of the currency. So they tend to claim that, well, if the state says that this is money, then this will be money. And the article proposes that they're both wrong. Obviously, the Chartists are less closer to the truth than the Austrians. But what I propose is that actually the value of fiat currencies is like any other asset. It is subjective. Like Menger and the original Austrians used to emphasize, value is always objective. And it's no different for fiat currencies than for oranges or for stocks. So the article proposes that actually the value of fiat currencies is based on supply and demand, and we need both. We don't, it's not just the supply side, so the quantity side, but it's also the demand side that matters a lot. So I think that's the first stepping stone of my article.
Yeah, before we're going to go on to the other points, let's just, you know, just stand still for a moment and I want to ask you, since, you know, the dollar, US dollar is the international reserve currency, the global, you know, reserve currency, and it's responsible or it's demanded, right, by the global trade. How much, of a factor is that? Like, we're talking about like the global trade volume of whatever, 70, 80 trillion. Like, is that one of the primary reasons the demand is so strong, or because it's gonna, procrastinate it until whatever we see some kind of potential real inflation, like
I think that's a really
hyperinflation?
good point because, yeah, like you say, the US dollar is different from other fiat currencies in that it has more demand. It has demand for international trade. Also, the oil market, which is the largest market out there, is priced in US dollars. So if you want to buy a barrel of oil, you need dollars. Or at least things are starting to change in that regard. But up till now, it was like that. So that's definitely a source of demand. But we can think of other sources like the coronavirus crisis, for instance. Everyone's at home and you're holding to your cash, you're demanding cash, you're not spending it. So that's also a source of money demand that could dampen inflation. Let's say if the supply of money increases, but the people are still spending the same amount of money or more, then you would expect prices to go up. But since people are locked down, they can't really spend much. That's another source of demand for cash balances. So yeah, I think you're right. And actually, what it actually says is that if the dollar is in trouble, then we can expect pretty much every other currency to be in a bigger trouble than the dollar because they have less demand for, like you say, for international trade and other commodity markets.
You probably have heard of, I've had him on my show. I'm probably going to have him again, maybe together with Stephanie von Jahn, Dr. Markus Krall, Thorsten Polleit, these Austrian economists, but especially Markus Krall is still like, on the extreme side. He sees like total like insolvency waves coming in Europe and European Union. So that he sees, I mean, he prognosticizes that, the euro is going to crash by 2021. So, but that's, his assessment. I mean, can you explain, like, can you relate to the euro? Like, because if anything happens, it's going to first happen in the European Union, right?
Do you mean in regards to the inflation risks or
Insolvencies, inflation, overdebtness, I mean, he calls it like, senioral capital is going to be like used up or something. I don't know what his, precise definition is that. Senioral, like rent-seeking capital, probably by the central bank. So he relates that to the GDP. So I'm not sure how he defines that, but if anything happens, I think we're going to first see it in the European Union. That's my point,
I think I can see more risks, political risks in the European Union, definitely. I mean, I'm not sure. I think lately there's been some agreement about debt utilization, but I think the political risks are definitely higher. I think the banking system in Europe is a lot weaker, especially because of negative interest rates, which are undercapitalizing the banking sector. We can see that in Spain. Like Spanish banks are just they're just crushing. They're going through the floor. All the stocks are going down, and the outlook is very negative in Spain, in Italy, and I think European banking system overall, that's probably because of negative interest rates, which we haven't seen so far in the US. And regarding the more macroeconomic variables, well, if you look at debt to GDP, the European Union is slightly below the US, and the deficit is also slightly below. So I see maybe from a macroeconomic standpoint, I see the US in a weaker position, at least for now, when it comes to the fiscal position, the deficit, and the debt. And the EU has big political challenges ahead, and the banking system, I think, is also like a big. It's a big problem, and that's without going to mention the dynamics of the markets in Europe, which is obviously there's less innovation, there's more barriers to competition and to trade, which is a bigger advantage in the US. But just looking at the macroeconomics, I'm not entirely sure which would be the weakest horse I would bet against. If the dollar or the euro, it would be a very difficult trade for me. I wouldn't. I'm not quite sure which side that could go.
What about this whole discussion? I mean, I see more the imminent threat, but it's somehow they're trying, I think, to prepare the ground for that, for the central bank digital currency. Where do you see the reset phase for that? I mean, I mean, when we're talking about central bank digital currency, that means centralized, monopolized, socialized, total like cashless society. Is that a danger you see in general in European Union? I mean,
I think that's a big threat towards
imminent, like imminent, or do you see that like in 10, 20 years coming or?
I don't think it's imminent because Germany is strongly opposed. The German culture is favors cash and is quite conservative from a monetary standpoint. You know, they're always worried about these measures that the ECB is taking, and I don't see that as something being imminent. But Spain, the Spanish PM, Prime Minister, the President, has been pushing for this in a reckless manner, and it was actually the ECB, I think, that had to say, "Look, like you can't just ban cash. It's against the." You know, the laws or the norms of the European Union. So there's a wide range of opinions, but I don't see it as an imminent threat. I do see it as a big problem going ahead, but luckily we have Bitcoin, which is definitely is going to become more important than ever. Well, because as you've discussed, I think in your own show, like when we have digital currencies and we have a bank account with the central bank, they can impose negative rates that go down to whatever, 5%, 7%, 10% per annum. It's effectively, just pillaging people's savings, making you consume, making you invest, even when the circumstances don't favor it, or you just don't like it, or maybe just against your own will. So it's just another form of taxation and very dangerous. It threatens our liberties and it threatens our economy too. So I
It's a
think it's
form
more.
of dictatorship. I mean, it's systematic. It's just a systematic bail-in than, you know, what we've had, you know, in 2013, 14 in Cyprus. I mean, that was peanuts probably. So with a central bank digital currency, I mean, this is like I mean, I see a huge danger, you know, of this is a form of oppression that we've never had probably in you know, in history.
I think, and the fact that they can monitor every one of our transactions is just, it's very scary. And on the other hand, fiscal policy and monetary policy are going to become two sides of the same coin because they can use the currency to tax us. It's just the same thing. It's a more convenient way of taxation, unless there's alternatives, which luckily people are working on. And I know Bitcoin right now is not feasible as a monetary alternative due to the high fees. But let's hope that the engineers keep working hard, and we have a we have an alternative system which can't be controlled by bureaucrats. Or it's an important mission ahead for sure.
You wrote somewhere in your article, you know, the trust of the investors. I don't know what did you think when you wrote that line, that the trust of the investors. You mean also like, you know, companies like, you know, when we're talking about like Michael Saylor of MicroStrategy. I mean, this is not going to be like a one-time example. I think there's a lot of discussions going on right now in the boardrooms, in the back rooms of the boardrooms. Do you see that like unexpectedly, exponentially rising? You know, those kind of cases where board members or the board of those companies decide to, you know, put their excess, whatever cash reserves or treasury reserves into like Bitcoin?
I think with trust, investor trust, I'm considering fiat currencies like a financial asset. So I think of us as investors when we choose to hold fiat, we are actually, in a sense, we're holding another asset which has a counterparty risk, maybe not nominal counterparty risk, but a very real counterparty risk in the sense that we don't know how much it's going to buy tomorrow, and that's all that matters. That we don't want pieces of paper. I mean, I'm not interested in having 1,000 euros. I want to know what's the buying power of those 1,000 euros. And Michael Saylor obviously has reached the same conclusion, and he seems to think that it's not going to be much in the future. That's why he's with regards to the dollar, he's converted it into Bitcoin, and I do think that that's going to be a trend in the coming in the coming future. I was surprised at the magnitude of the purchase. Because it's going to fluctuate a lot, so I would presume it's going to be more of a gradual kind of a gradual shift. And as Bitcoin gains adoption, it grows its market cap and it becomes more stable. I would say then it might even become the preferred cash balance asset in the coming years. But I think we're still quite far away from that because it's such a volatile instrument that I don't see large companies holding a large percentage of the. Of their cash reserves for now, but I think it's definitely going to become a trend. I see it more in individuals. You know, if individuals are more sovereign, you don't have to reports to the board of directors every month or every 3 months. So I think I think the impulse is going to keep coming from individual investors.
Like you mean not only like average like individual, but also like ultra net high worth individuals, family offices maybe, you know?
Definitely. Family offices, large wealthy holders of other assets who are going to see Bitcoin as a good alternative. Yeah, for sure.
Do you think because we've heard this statement, I don't know, from all kinds of hedge fund managers, even from Michael Saylor or Jeff Booth, he says, you know, it's actually, you know, pretty irresponsible not to hold a certain percentage of your wealth in Bitcoin. What do you think about this? I mean, you know, all these statements. I mean, have you heard, like, listened all to also some interviews of Michael Saylor and others, or Michael, or what's his name, Powell Tudor Jones? And do you think this is accelerating?
Yeah, I think it's people don't seem to see it so far, but I think it's kind of a change of perspective. When you look at it that way, you think to yourself, actually, it's so reckless. Not holding any Bitcoin is probably the most reckless decision you can make right now. Not holding like even a small percentage of your wealth, it's incredibly reckless because of what we were talking about before. Because if you hold fiat currencies, you don't know what's going to be their buying power in a month. You don't even know if the banking system, like we were saying, it's been so damaged and it's still being completely eaten away by negative interest rates. We don't know if our cash is going to be readily available in the future. If you have 10,000 euros in your account, well, if the bank is in trouble, it doesn't have your 10,000 euros. It's a promise to pay you 10,000 euros. And if they don't have it, well, they're going to do what they always did. They're going to say, no, look, we're going to give it to you maybe in a month, maybe in 3, maybe in a year, maybe in 3 years. And in that time, well, you don't know how much that 1,000 euros is going to be worth. It's something we were talking about the EU before, something I don't really consider to be outlandish at all is to think that maybe if the banking system keeps getting into trouble and becomes decapitalized, especially with this COVID cut crisis, so many loans are going to be underperforming and they're going to be wiped out from the balance sheet. We could see some form of soft capital controls in the European banking system. I don't think this is going to happen tomorrow, but I think it's something perfectly possible. I mean, I'm quite familiar with the case of Argentina. And there weren't many warnings when they had the corralito there and they couldn't access their deposits. Something that, we don't really think about enough is our bank deposits. We are giving the ownership of the cash to the bank. The cash is not there. The bank doesn't hold it. It's actually using it to leverage up and to give out loans. And we're seeing so many of these loans going underwater that I would say, given the circumstances, not having any Bitcoin, any Bitcoin is a real asset, isn't it? It's no one's. It hasn't doesn't have any counterparty risk. If you own Bitcoin, no one needs to give you anything in return. You just have your Bitcoin, you have your keys, and not having a real asset that is nobody else's liability today in this environment, I think is a very reckless decision.
You know, we've heard about also fiduciary responsibilities. So, you know, because I found it funny when Michael Saylor, you know, told the story, like how this decision-making process took place in the boardroom, and then he found out that half of the board members, they had already invested into Bitcoin, you know, and he didn't know that. So, it see at least it seemed like the way he told the story, they, you know, he didn't know. So, do you think there's sort of a regulatory or you know, internal obstruction, like hindrance to make these kind of decisions? Like, are maybe are decision makers, you know, in those, whatever, you could be even in pension funds, you know, or family offices, pension funds, or, you know, especially pension funds, who are sitting globally, I don't know, on how much, 50, 60, $70 trillion worth. You know, do you think some decision makers are waiting for that moment where they can at least, you know, where they're free to make those kind of decisions, you know, put at least whatever 5, 10, 20% into Bitcoin?
I think with Michael Saylor, as I understand, he's the majority shareholder, so he could unanimously almost make that decision. But most companies have the board, executive board, they have a shareholder meetings, so that's a hindrance. But then again, if we start to see inflation, then I'm sure no one is going to oppose to having some of the cash in a hard asset that can't be inflated. And regarding the regulations, yeah, that's something that I haven't looked into in depth, but I presume that pension funds have some limitations towards whether they can invest into Bitcoin yet. And I would assume that once the market cap grows, Bitcoin matures and it becomes less volatile, then we will see pension funds coming in larger sums. But at the moment, I don't know of any pension. I don't know if you're aware of any, but I'm not aware of any pension funds that are buying Bitcoin at the moment.
Oh, I think Pompliano, Anthony Pompliano, he, I think he, you know, with his, what is this called? I don't know what's his company called. I forget that. But isn't some kind of pension fund of the police and fire department? I think, yeah, they're taking care of their sort of assets. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. But it's still marginal, you know, so, but it's taking place already, you know, that's what I'm saying.
If you want to get into a bit more of the article, or well, it's up to you.
Yeah, I want to know, how do you see like the economy like evolving once, like what would be for you from your perspective, like what is like you know, what is a critical adoption rate within the economy where you could would say, okay, this is then, you know, the this would be the preparation for the next phase into, you know, whatever, medium of exchange, settlement layer, unit of account. Is that something like far off from your perspective?
Yeah, I see it. I see it. Just at the moment, I see Bitcoin as a store of value, or more of a speculative asset. So, personally, it's so volatile. Money tends to be the most liquid good in an economy, and tends to be the good that is more stable in value. And we can all agree that that's not Bitcoin right now. And I don't think it's going to be Bitcoin in a while because it has so long to appreciate. It's so small, you know, it's only 200 billion, odd 200 billion or so.
Plus minus.
So it needs to grow so much in market cap before it can become a medium of account, let alone a medium of exchange, let alone a unit of account. So I would expect this speculative kind of a price discovery, value discovery phase to go on for quite a few years. Until there's enough adoption, let's say large percentage, or maybe quite a large percentage of the population owns some of it, and then we can expect its value to stabilize, and then it will become a very liquid good, which it is not right now. It's not liquid at all. You know, if you want to buy sell a large number of Bitcoins, you're going to make the price drop most probably, and the opposite is also true. If you want to buy a large amount, then the price is going to shoot up. So in order for it to be money, it needs to be the most liquid good, according to Menger. And I think it makes sense, even though Menger wrote so long ago. And I think we still have a long way until that happens. And it's a great path, you know, it's a great journey until then. And I think it offers great opportunities for investors and traders.
Yeah, makes sense. You know, you probably read Parker Lewis articles also, his series Gradual and Suddenly. Is that something you can, I mean, what are your thoughts on that process, you know, of like gradually and suddenly? Could it be like, could it come suddenly, like because of, you know, external factors, macro geopolitical factors playing out?
It's an interesting thesis, but I don't think we're there yet. I think we're still quite far away, but once there's a critical mass that starts adopting it, then is where the expectations become important, and the trust becomes very important. And if merchants start demanding they be paid in Bitcoin, then we're going to see like if people fleeing the fiat system and using Bitcoin for the day-to-day transactions. But I don't think we're there yet, because if you look at prices of commodities, of labor, of factors of production, they're still relatively stable until now, you know. So I would be looking at prices of factors of production, such as commodities, if they start picking up and wages start picking up, and if we see maybe inflation linked bonds that also start spiking up, then we're facing a currency collapse. Then we can see the suddenly part that Parker alludes to. I think, but I'm not seeing that. I don't think we can see that yet. But it's something to keep our eyes peeled for sure. Yeah.
The how much is the I think Preston Pish once talked about the bond market. Is that like $100 trillion market, the bond market?
Yeah, I think at least 100 trillion.
You don't
yeah.
see a risk like you know what if the bond market implodes?
I see a huge risk, Mm-hmm. And well, the thing is, if it implodes, well, let's say if it implodes, it's going to look like inflation. It's not going to. I don't think we're going to see it nominally collapse because the central banks are buying. They have a bid that's a floor to the price. So we're not going to see yields go up substantially, at least not for now, because they can print limited money, you know, they can print limited reserves. The primary dealers, so you have these banks, and in the US and in Europe is the same mechanism. They have to buy. If they have reserves, they have to buy the treasury issuance. So so we might not see it nominally. We might see bonds collapsing through inflation, which is the same thing. In real terms, their purchasing power is collapsing. Now, are we there yet? Not yet. We need to look at the spread between the TIPS, the treasury inflated bonds, and the nominal bond. So if you have treasury inflated bonds, unless the Fed starts buying those too, but then we would be in a complete circus. I mean, this would be a shamble of an economy. So and we should see the TIPS. And this is something that Lacey Hunt talks about, and I learned from him, and it was really insightful. We don't really see TIPS going up substantially. We have seen them pick up a bit. They actually went down, signaling deflation expectations after the COVID crisis, or during the burst of the COVID crisis in March. But now they're picking up a bit, but we're not seeing a substantial rise in inflated treasuries, inflation-linked treasuries. So I would be looking at that, and like I said, commodity prices. If those start shooting up, then we're looking at outright inflation, and then the central bank needs to intervene if it wants to preserve the value of the currency. And in the article, I argue that they're going to have big trouble doing so successfully. So I think that's how I'm currently thinking about the risks of the bond collapse and of inflation. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. What are your thoughts on gold, like Bitcoin in relation to gold? Or what do you think is a perception of people when we talk about like relative scarcity of gold, absolute scarcity of Bitcoin? Because, let's just talk about the fundamental properties, the different fundamental properties of Bitcoin and gold. Because there seems to be like gold bugs, highly intelligent gold bugs, you know, experts, Austrian economists, even. They seem not to get it, or they don't, or maybe because they're biased or working for a gold, you know, company. Yeah. Where do you see the fundamental differences in between gold and Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a generational, in many ways, it's a generational shift or border barrier, or however you want to call it. There's that saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, isn't there? And I think, when you've been reading books about how great gold is and how it's has intrinsic value and is the best thing that ever happened to mankind, then it's going to be really hard for you to change your mind. And I, funny enough, I was a gold bug until not that long ago, but eventually I started reading on Bitcoin, and then you know, there's so many compelling arguments for why Bitcoin is a superior alternative to gold. And I'm not saying that I don't think gold is going to collapse, like, because maybe like a lot of these investment institutions, like pension funds, like investment funds, like we said before, they can't really buy Bitcoin. So they're buying the second best thing in town, you know, which is gold. And I reckon that's why it's going up. Apart from this inertia, this habit of buying gold as an inflation hedge or as a risk. But in the long run, I don't see gold being like a key asset in the global kind of financial system. I reckon Bitcoin, like you said, because of its absolute scarcity, but also because of so many other things, you know,
yeah.
It's infinitely divisible. It's digital. I mean, come on.
And you can't transfer gold electronically, you know. And how are you gonna assay or verify the authenticity or the purity of the gold? I mean, there's just so many factors, right?
Yeah, and the arguments for gold and against Bitcoin are really, they're really crap, mediocre arguments. Like things like it doesn't have intrinsic value, but we know that value is subjective. As there's not such thing as intrinsic value, or it's not tangible, which is actually its greatest virtue. Bitcoin not being tangible is what allows it to be sent online, and we can move through borders with it, which is memorizing a bunch of words. So, when you think about it carefully, I don't think there's a competition going on at all. I'm not really that interested in gold.
Do you think, you're the Austrian economist, I read a little bit, Rothbard, Hayek, do you think all these Austrian economists would how would they think about Bitcoin? Wouldn't they because there was never like a money at that time with, unlike gold, which they always say that it has an intrinsic value, industrial value or something like that, like it's physical, right? But Bitcoin is like totally non-physical. It's Do you think they would have welcomed Bitcoin, such as Mises, Hayek, or?
It's a good question. I would say Rothbard definitely would be a fan, as long as he wasn't too dogmatic about his previous views. Because Rothbard actually writes, he says the ideal money is the one with absolute scarcity. We want the best money is that one which we cannot increase its supply. So if he's consistent with his views, then we should expect him to be buying sats every morning. And
And
getting
Hayek with his sly roundabout, that's this
yeah
famous quote of
yeah
him, we can't take the whatever the control of the money or something like that out of the hands of government, but not at least not violently, but only with a sort of through a sly roundabout way. Isn't that what Hayek would have dreamt about? I was asking myself.
yeah for sure. Hayek, in my mind, he's the brightest of them all. I mean, he's my favorite for sure. And when he wrote Before the Great Depression, he also held similar views. It was the Great Depression that made him change his mind, and he actually advocated for increasing the supply of money in the event of a banking crisis like what we had in 29. But then again, I think he would actually understand that under a Bitcoin standard, we wouldn't have fractional reserve banking, and we wouldn't really have banking crisis that would need such a monetary expansion. And Hayek was an advocate of deflation too. Like he thought that a gross deflation, so the deflation that comes from capitalism, from an entrepreneurship, increasing the amount of goods and services that we produce, that leads to deflation. That leads to us buying more things for less money. And he was a big advocate of that. So I would presume Hayek would favor Bitcoin, yeah, greatly. And Menger, I would think so too. So I think most Austrians would be in favor of it. It's only there is a line of Austrians, latest one, who are in favor of free banking and the gold standard. Some Austrians, and they are, they're quite vocal. They have been quite vocal against Bitcoin, and it's kind of hard to understand. I think there's a degree of inconsistency there, which I don't know. It's hard. It would be interesting to hear more debates about why they believe that the fixed money, the fixed supply is an economic problem.
That would be really fascinating. So, Gael, I'm probably know that I'm working with some other Bitcoiners and people from the film in sort of film experience people like on a project. We want to do a film, and since you also mentioned Jeff Booth in your article, do you see like a few, you read probably Jeff Booth's book, right? So where do you how do you see like a civilization society evolve with a, as Jeff Booth says, technology is deflationary, principally, right? So do you see like how do you see a society evolving into such kind of, monetary, economical, scientific, technological evolution?
Well, I'd say that we have experienced like such a high degree of innovation, and technology has brought such an increase in living standards worldwide. I imagine that multiplied by, I don't know, 10 or 100, because human ingenuity is great when it's allowed to work freely. And if we have a smaller state, if we have a monetary system based on Bitcoin, which allows for deflation, which enables economic calculation without interferences from central banks, without bailouts, without bailing out the losers, you know, these big corporations who just have ties to government and they're eating away at our scarce resources like labor, like goods, like commodities. And if that capital and those factors of production are deployed towards endeavors that truly add value, and that can only be done if we don't have interferences from central banks and from governments, then I think we could flourish as a society. Yeah, I think Mars is not the limit. It's way beyond Mars. So I see deflation as a key ingredient towards a prosperous future. And it's funny that so many economists cringe and they have such a, you know, deep-rooted fear of deflation, of falling prices, which is probably the most ludicrous thing that personally I have ever encountered in academia. Because, I mean, come on, like, the arguments against deflation are just, they're terrible. They don't stand at all. I think Jeff Booth's book is great. I really like Philip Baggers. I don't know if you have him on the show. He's German, and he teaches Austrian economics at the Masters that I mentioned at the start of the interview in Madrid. And he has a book called In Defense of Deflation. And it's great. It's a brilliant book, and it goes through deflation, what causes deflation. So he mainly differentiates between growth deflation, which comes from us producing more things. So if we produce more apples, prices of apples go down, etc. And then he mentions the credit deflation, and that's the problematic one, because, and it comes from our banking system, which is based on fractional reserve and maturity mismatching. And if we get rid of that, I think economic cycles they wouldn't really happen. We would have companies failing, but capital would be allocated a lot more efficiently towards endeavors that really add value to society, so we can expect a prosperous future. Yeah, for sure.
Right. Let me ask you before we wrap up, this is really important, because I had Titus Gebel on together with Jeff Booth, and Titus Gebel, you know, is the founder of Free Private Cities. He actually has now his first official project in Honduras. Where do you see the role of the government? I mean, don't you think that with a Bitcoin standard and, you know, the whole structure centered around with a truly free market, with true capitalism, with true, you know, protection of private property rights, liberty, health, you know, well-being, a private contractual partner, you know, service provider, could do all these things that the government should be actually doing much more efficiently, cheaper. What is your position? Like, like, could we, like, just get rid of, like, make our governments obsolete?
Yeah, I mean, I think the state is exists in order to ensure a set of rules that we agree on. But then again, how do we agree on them? So the private cities initiative is a way to decentralize the stateship and to have rules that you agree with. And I think that's the future. So we should go towards smaller states where, you know, if you want to live in an anarchist society, in an anarcho-capitalist, or it wouldn't be anarchist because you would have some form of a state, I guess.
A contract, right? Yeah, between the citizens and, you know, private contractual partner. You could be a company, you could be a service provider, you know, I do, and then you guarantee me, you know, on contractual basis, that you're going to, you know, secure and protect my security, my well-being, you know, my property, you know. And I mean, it's never been done. We don't have capitalism anymore. This is something, you know, you talked about deflation, you know, it's like so much indoctrination going on in the minds of people. I mean, who would object to a deflationary society where you pay less and less for better, more efficient, more innovative, technological, unimaginable, you know, technology services, whatever that is, you know, from robotics to energy to transportation systems.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. I mean, I think it would be great if we could have a decentralized states where you live with the rules that you agree with. We would need some way to deal with externalities and, you know, conflicts between different states, but it's a bright future, I think, politically too. Yeah, we could have a lot of innovation there. It's going to be interesting, but definitely if the monetary system changes, states are also going to have to change. So it's going to be great to see how these, where it takes us, for sure.
Awesome. Well, Gael, thank you so much. Maybe we can repeat some kind of discussion with you, and I'm imagining, you know, with Stephanie, Ben, Emil, or some other, you know, economists. So where can people find you? Any other info I missed?
No, they can find me on Twitter. It's Gael Sandsmith, and I'm always happy to discuss and share ideas, and probably be putting a few more articles out there. So yeah, it'll be great to hear from people. And thanks
for the amazing work. Thank you, Gael, for your time. All right, talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Bye. All right, so that was amazing. As usual, it's amazing knowledge. I didn't even know that there's, you know, some people out there who are really doing amazing, you know, Austin economics on masters, PhDs, whatever. So I think we're gonna see like a new renaissance of Austin economists. So yeah, I wanted to talk about not only Bitcoin, but like how this future could look like on a Bitcoin standard or in a hyper Bitcoinized world and deflationary, monetary economical society, where, you know, we have true freedom, true prosperity, abundance, ingenuity, you know, as Gael said. So make sure you follow him, like, retweet, share, follow me on YouTube, on podcast platforms. Thank you so much again for your support. And if you want to contribute in any shape or form to our Freedom Project with a working title, Human Life Rooted in Bitcoin, give me a DM or email. And whether it be graphics, music, film experience, film production, post-production, or you want to fund it, sponsor it in any shape or form, let me know. Thank you so much again. I'll see you soon.